Okay, we'll start with something from the beginning of the Sedra. Hatsur Tamim Pa'alo Kichol Drachav Mishpat. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter asks, people are also supposed to be just. We're all supposed to do Mishpat. So what's so special about the Rabbanu Shel Olam Kichol Drachav Mishpat? That all his ways are just. So he says the following. I'll give you a marshal to what he says. What would you say in the following scenario? Person gets bored on his lunch hour, and he goes to the nearest McDonald's and shoots everybody there in cold blood, men, women, children, whoever's in the McDonald's. And he does this quite a few times till they finally catch him. And they bring him before a judge and a jury. And the judge asks him if he regrets killing all these poor people in cold blood. He said, no, it's a thrill for him to do this. He gets very bored on his lunch hour, and he doesn't enjoy computer games, and this is the only way that really he enjoys himself. Would you do it again? Yeah, if I got bored, I would do it again. What would you say would be the fair punishment for such a person? Death penalty? Probably. Unless you belong to the ACLU, right? Maybe, for this person, he says he would kill again. It would be a deterrent to other people. He's a cold-blooded murderer. So it would seem that giving him the death penalty would be a fair thing. However, let me fill you in on a few other important facts. This man is, for all other purposes, a frum person, married to a wonderful Esh Yisrael, who never was affected by his killing people in McDonald's because she never ate McDonald's. And he was a perfect husband. Perfect husband. He bought her flowers and he helped her. He took out the garbage. He was a really good guy. And she didn't even know this part of his personality. She never even knew that he goes and kills people in McDonald's in his spare time. And never affected her. When she was going out, the Shadchan just happened to not mention this part of his personality. Wasn't that important. In any case, so she married this guy, and now if we give him the death penalty, she's going to be a widow. She's going to lose her support. She's going to lose a very, very fine husband. Do you think that's fair for her? No, I don't think so. It was a model father. Took his kids on picnics and learned with them in Ovo Subbanim. He never harmed his children. Never killed them. They were never in McDonald's either. So he was a very, very fine father. And they're going to be orphans. Do you think that's fair for them? No. He also was the best worker in his factory. And if he is executed, the factory owner will go bankrupt. Is that fair? I don't think so. So what do we have over here? We have that even though the judge has to judge this person without looking at the collateral damage that's caused, and it's just to execute this person, but there's a lot of collateral damage here that maybe isn't just. But a human judge can only judge what's in front of him and not what the repercussions are going to be. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on the other hand, is Hatsur Tamim Pa'alo Kichol Drachav Nishpat. Everything the Rabbanu Shalom does is just. That means that whoever is affected by anybody's judgment, and we all are affected by everybody because we're all intertwined, deserves to be affected as much as he's affected. Not more, not less. And that is one of the ways that we can daven for other people. Because davening does not change God's mind. Davening changes the person. And when you change, you may deserve a different judgment. What you deserve before you daven may be different after you daven. Davening is only one of many factors that can change a person's condition. Mitzvahs, chesed, tzedakah, millions of things that can change a person's condition. When the condition changes, so the judgment changes. That's one of the ways that davening works. It doesn't change God's mind. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that Rachmana Litzlan, a person's sick, and he davens to the Rabbanu Litzlan, Rabbanu Litzlan, please make me well. Why doesn't God turn around and say, look, I know you're sick. Nothing happens in this world that I'm not involved in. I made you sick. And I do everything for the good. And there's a reason why you're sick. And when the reason goes away, I'd be happy to make you well. What are you chepping me for? Imagine if you had a person in the hospital. The doctor comes and examines him, and he says that he needs a very painful operation, but he's sure the operation will ensure him 50 happy, healthy years. He will survive the operation and have 50 happy, healthy years. How do I know? I made up the muscle. I can make up the muscle any way I want. So it's clear. And if he doesn't have the operation, he will die in 2 hours, for sure. There's no in-between. Either he's dead in 2 hours, or he has 50 happy, healthy years. Now, this person doesn't like pain. So he pleads with the doctor, please, doctor, don't give me the operation. It's going to hurt. It's going to take time for me to recuperate. Don't give me the operation. If you were the doctor, would you listen to him? Even if he begged you? No. The guy's an idiot. He doesn't understand what the options are. So you'd ignore him, give him the operation, because you know it's good for him. So too, if the Rabbanu Shalom does something for somebody, even if it hurts, it's for his good, for his eternal good. So why in the world would the Rabbanu Shalom want to listen to our davening? Because we chepe him? Because we beg him? He knows it's not good for us. So why do we daven? The answer is that the marshal is not a good marshal. The marshal should be the following. Imagine, again, the guy's in the hospital. The doctor examines him and he says he needs a painful operation, and the operation will guarantee him 50 happy, healthy years. But, the doctor says, it's a shame that his body is so weak, because if he could exercise and strengthen his body, he could get away with bitter medicine. The same result of the operation could be gotten with bitter medicine, but his body is too weak to integrate the medicine, so he needs the operation. Now, if the person exercises and strengthens his body, the doctor comes back and he says, you know what, we don't need to give him the operation. Just give him the bitter medicine. And if he exercises even more, we could get away with sweet medicine. And that's what happens. He exercises more, and the doctor doesn't give him the operation, doesn't give him the bitter medicine, gives him the sweet medicine. What changed? Not the patient, not the doctor's mind. The doctor didn't change his mind. The doctor was constant and consistent. Condition A, proper operation. Condition B, bitter medicine. Condition C, sweet medicine. Same result. The question is, how can that result be brought about? Depends on the condition of the person. So when we daven, and a host of other things, we change our condition. And therefore, that's one of the ways that davening works. You don't change God's mind, you change your condition. There's only one problem with that. Then how do you daven for somebody else? Imagine again, the guy's in the hospital, needs the operation. The doctor says if he can only exercise and strengthen himself, we could get away with sweet medicine instead of the operation. So I say, look, doc, this guy's really weak. He can't exercise his fingers. But I'm his best friend. I'm going home. I'll exercise for him. So don't give him the operation. Just give him the sweet medicine. I promise you I'm exercising for him. Does that help? Obviously not. So how in the world do you daven for somebody else? If davening doesn't change God's mind, it changes the condition of the person. But one of the answers is that we are all interrelated. And if I am upset by somebody being sick, then I deserve to be upset. And if I daven and change, then maybe I don't deserve anymore to be upset. And therefore something has to change in the whole system. Because how I am affected by you affects you and affects me. And that is based on this idea. Because everybody is interrelated. Everything is justice. And whoever suffers from anybody's din only suffers because they deserve it. Not necessarily they're getting punished, but they need that for whatever reason. And if they don't need it because their condition changes, then something has to change in the whole system. It's one of the ways that davening for other people helps. It also, this concept explains another medrash. And there's many medrashim like this, and it's good to know how to understand them properly. Yes? Yeah. If somebody sins, whoever is affected by anybody's din, like in the case of the guy who's being executed, his wife suffers, his children suffer, his employer, they only, when the Rabban Shalom meets out those punishments, then anyone who suffers exactly what they need, that's what they get. And if they wouldn't need it, or they wouldn't deserve it, they wouldn't get it. Something else would happen that wouldn't affect them in the way that it's affecting them. Therefore, if I am affected, somebody's sick, and I'm upset by it, so there's a reason why I have to be upset. Now, if I daven and change and don't deserve to be upset anymore, then something's going to have to change with that person also. Yes? Yes and no, but I'm changing me, right? When you daven, you can change yourself tremendously or in a small way. Just the fact that you turn to the Ribono Shel Olam is in itself an improvement. It's something, right? It may not be enough to make the effect, right? If you do like this with your finger, you may be exercising, but it may not make the effect. But davening is one factor amongst many that can make an effect. It's not cause and effect that it for sure changes anything, but it could. Yes and no, but the major reason why you're suffering is that person's sick. So you're davening that the source of your pain should go away, that person's sickness. But you can understand with this something that you've learned, which you learned probably with a different idea, but now the idea is much simpler. If you need something and somebody else needs something, and you daven for them, you're answered first. So we normally think because you're a nice guy and you daven for somebody else, so God does you a favor. But if you can daven for somebody else and make enough change that it's going to affect them, it surely is going to affect you.
I understand that, but couldn't it also be that, for example, with the mashal of the person needing exercise, but he's too weak to do it, if the friend says, "Don't worry, I'll make sure to help him exercise,"
is it? Let's say you don't even know who you're davening for, and you're miles away from the person. You have no idea what's wrong with them. Are you helping them change? You don't even know they are.
But that's the thing. If, for example, I were standing next to them and all I had to do was help them lift their arms so they could exercise, I would do it. But with tefillah, obviously, it's not the same exact.
Okay. There's another maybe. What will make it more understandable what you're saying is the following. There's another aspect. It's not only how it affects me, but Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bozeh. We're all intertwined, and therefore we're all one system. And what affects part of the system affects all the system. Right? If somebody takes an antibiotic through their mouth, it goes into their digestive system and then into their into the blood. So it's not the digestive system, the blood, the toe that may be infected, it's you. And whatever affects one part of your system affects the whole system. So same thing over here. And therefore, if I daven, it's like you're davening too because we're all part of the same organism. That could be too. But it explains the following medrash. And there's a lot of medrashim similar to this. The medrash says, why Dina was violated, was attacked by Shechem. The Medrash says, why did that happen? So the Medrash says it was Yaakov's fault. Because Yaakov Avinu didn't want to marry her off to Esav. He hid her from Esav. Therefore, the Rabban Shalom said, you don't want to marry her off to a Jew. No, whatever kind of Jew Esav was, she's going to be attacked by a goy. Okay, that in itself needs explanation, but let's first get the basic idea before we go off on the side. Then the Medrash says, no, it's Leah's fault. Leah was a little bit immodest, and because of that, her daughter was attacked. Then the Medrash says, no, it was Dinah's fault. Dina acted a little immodest, and because of that, she was attacked. Does that medrash sit well with any of you? What's the problem with the medrash? Two things. First of all, somebody's not mentioned there. Whose fault it was? Shem. What about him? Okay. Secondly, it seems like the most distorted kind of logic, which is what secular courts do, Rachmana Litzlan, if a woman is attacked, they end up blaming her because she was looking for it and she wasn't as modest as she could have been or whatever. That's absurd. You make the victim into the perpetrator. That's what Chazal seem to be doing. And they just forget about Shem. And according to this, which I told you, the Medrash means the following. Of course Shem is the one to blame. And Shem got killed for it. And he's burning in Gehenna for it. But that's not enough to explain why the Rabban Shem permitted him to be successful. Shem doesn't run the world. God runs the world. Shem can want to do whatever he wants, but God could have protected Dina. And Dina wasn't the only one who suffered. Her father suffered. Her mother suffered. She suffered. Why did the Rabban Shem permit Shem to be successful and all these people suffered? So the Medrash has to find reasons not why Dina was attacked. She was attacked because of Shem, but why didn't the Rabban Shem stop it? Why did he permit it to happen? Because each one of them needed the suffering that they had. Dina needed what she had. There must be a reason why. So there has to be a reason for Dina. Leah needed the suffering she had because of this. There must be a reason for Leah. Yaakov needed the suffering that he had. There must be a reason for Yaakov. That's what these medrashim mean. It's not to blame them that because of them, that's why it happened. It happened because Shem was a Rasha and he got punished for it. But the Ribono Shel Olam runs the world. Why didn't he stop it? Why did he permit these people to suffer? The answer is each one needed that suffering for a different reason. But if there wouldn't be a reason why they needed that suffering, then they wouldn't have been affected. Then it wouldn't have happened. Yeah.
So let's say you have a person in the family, their daughter's sick, right? And she's the one who ends up passing away, but everybody else suffers tremendously from it. Like, what are you going to see that? And then let's say the person's amazing, amazing person, and she's, like, you never find any fault in her. So you're going to see everybody else, she's getting punished. She's the one who has to leave this world because everybody else needs to suffer.
No. She had her reason why she had to leave this world. It may have been nothing to do with a punishment. It may be she fulfilled what she was supposed to fulfill, and she was able to go on to a higher level in Gan Eden, which is good for her if you could see the future. But the Maisa, people suffered because of her. So each one had to have a reason why they needed that suffering. It's not necessarily because they got a punishment. They needed it because it made them a better person. Well, it could be a million reasons, but there's a reason. It's not just for nothing. That's the idea. Okay, I was afraid that somebody was going to remember that I said I was going to... Okay, it's off the topic, but I'll explain it. Right, L'chor, according to this part of the Medrash, it would seem that the way to look for a mate, or if you're looking for your daughter, you know, looking for possible husbands, you should go to the Port Authority or the Tel Aviv bus station, find some druggie who is drunk and totally spaced out, kick him, and say, boy, I have a girl for you. Maybe she'll be mashpi on you. I mean, that's what the Ribono Shel Olam said to Esav, to Yaakov. You hid your daughter away from Esav, and if maybe Esav would have wanted her, and they would have gotten married, maybe Dina would have had a good influence on Esav. And you held back that tova from Esav. Now, with all due deference to the Medrash, there is another possibility. That Uncle Esav would have had a bad influence on Dina, right? Not Dina having a good influence on Esav. So how in the world could Yaakov Avinu have taken a chance with his daughter and done something that may have benefited Esav but may have destroyed Dina? So the Alter from Slabotka says the following. He says that Yaakov Avinu did 100% the right thing. He hid Dina away because their chance that maybe Esav would marry her and Esav would do tshuva, or maybe Esav would marry her and destroy her. So when you have a dilemma like that, you don't do anything. So he had to hide her away. He did 100% the right thing. You know what the problem was? When he knocked the nails in the box, he did it with a too much enthusiasm. What Yaakov should have felt is the following. I really, really feel bad that I can't take a chance and marry my daughter to Esav and perhaps turn him into a tzaddik. But I can't take that chance with my daughter, and I have to hide her away. And he should have been crying that he wasn't able to be mashpia on Esav. But he didn't. He wasn't crying. He did it with a little too much enthusiasm, meaning that the Rabban Hashem said, I sense that it's not because of your concern for Dina that you hid her away, so it's a little bit because you're lacking concern for Esav. That was why he was punished. Not because he didn't marry her to Esav, because it didn't bother him that he couldn't be mashpia on Esav. He did the right thing, but how you feel about it also makes a difference. Yeah.
So, what source for it not bothering him?
What? Only for the fact that the Medrash says, is one of the reasons why he suffered. And what's the Midah Keneged Midah? The Rabban Hashem said, let me show you. If you're so, so concerned about your daughter, and that was the only reason you hid her away, not because you're not concerned about Esav, but you're so concerned about her, how did you let her go out and get attacked? Must be that you're not so concerned about her as much as you think. So it must be that a little bit there is disconcern for Esav. Yeah.
Well, how quickly can you judge him for having disconcern for Esav? Esav tried to kill him.
Okay, but still, Yaakov should have wanted to bring the world to its completion and take this Russia out of the world. Yaakov Avinu functioned on a different plane than we function also, and he's held, therefore, much more responsible. Okay, let's go to something else. One more thing. Therefore, one of the biggest zechuyos that a person can have for Rosh Hashanah, for Yom HaDin, is to be somebody that other people depend on, that other people need. Because then you're not just judged on your own merits, but you're judged on all those other people that need you on their merits too. Somebody, let's say, every day goes and buys groceries for an old widow in his building. Brings her groceries home. Another guy, takes care of him, calls him every morning to make sure he's still alive or whatever. Right? There's a lot of people that depend on this person. He gives another one a ride to davening every day. And this person, whatever, his judgment comes up on Rosh Hashanah, and not so good. But then the Rabban Shalom says, yeah, but if I punish him and make him sick, who's going to take care of this poor widow? And she doesn't deserve that she shouldn't be taken care of. And who's going to take care of the guy who he drives to shul? And who's going to take care of the guy he calls every day to make sure he's well? So the fact that other people depend on you, and they would be adversely affected if you had a negative din, changes your din too, because people need you. So one of the best ways to be zoche badin is to be somebody that other people depend on, that need you. If other people need you, then you're not only judged on your own merits, you're judged according to them also. Yeah.
So we should be dependent on people so that they.
No, you should have other people dependent on you.
Right, but let's say I love my sister.
Okay. No, you don't have to. What's it called? You don't have to go around trying to make other people you dependent on other people. They'll worry about that. You have to worry about yourself.
If I know she's not going to have a good job in the Rosh
Hashanah,
and I care about her.
So you want to give her others a chuyos. But you can, what's it called? Yeah, what you can do is look for good things in your sister that inspire you to do good things, and then you'll be dependent on her for those inspiration, and that's also part of it.
But you can't have to punish that guy who's so needed while still making sure that the old lady.
Yeah, the Rabban Hashem can do it, but it's another factor in lessening this person's din, because there has to be another factor taken into consideration. It's not simple. Nothing is simple. Right? And it's not something that we can fathom how it works. It's not just easy. But amongst the millions of causes and effects, this is another one that makes it not black and white anymore. Yeah. No. It's, again, it's not black and white. It's just one factor amongst many that goes into the hopper that wouldn't go in if this wasn't the case. That's all. It's not going to change the person's din. This guy really is a Russia and who knows what, but this old lady needs him, so therefore, what's it called, we're going to keep up this godfather because let him kill 1,000 other people during the year because he helps some poor widow. It doesn't work so simple. But the fact that he helps that poor widow is going to be a factor, right, that's going to have to be considered.
But what if, say there's a thief, and he raises all these tiny little thieves on the street, and he teaches them all how to be thieves, and they all depend on his big thieveries to get his food and stuff. He's not teaching right, he's not doing right, and yet these people are all depending on him.
Like, yeah, sometimes people depend on you for wrong things.
Right.
And then better that person shouldn't be around, so these people will not revert to thievery.
Okay,
that's why we need the Rabban Hashem to take care of this and not me. Okay? Each case, again, how exactly it works out is beyond us. But that it is a factor, yeah, it's a factor. Okay, I have about 10 things here to speak about. We spoke about one so far. So we're doing okay. Next. There's a famous Netziv. We won't spend too much time on this. I just want to mention it, though. It's important. The Netziv on the Pasuk, Tzadik v'yosher hu. God is a Tzadik and a Yosher. He's righteous and straight. Says the Netziv, these words, Tzadik v'yosher, is a tzidduk hadin, it is an acceptance of the judgment of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. He brings rayas, medrashim, whatever, that accepting the fact that we deserve the second Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is tzaddik v'yosher. And why he says? He says because the avos were called yesharim. Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYosher. Because the avos were yesharim. Now what does that mean, yesharim? They were big chassidim, tzaddikim. They learned Torah, they observed the Torah. What was missing that they also had to be called yesharim? Says the Netziv, it's possible for a person to be a tzaddik and a chassid and a person who learns Torah and he shouldn't be yosher. Yosher means that the way he deals with other human beings, not necessarily even Jews, but certainly Jews, is straight, honest, and with mercy and compassion. And even though, he says, Avraham Avinu hated the wickedness of Sodom, but he davened for them that they should survive, that they should give up the wickedness, because he loved them as human beings. And he was straight with them. And he dealt with even the lowest people in a very straightforward and honest way. That is Yosher, as opposed to the people in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. What was the chait that destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash? Sinas Chinam. Says in the Netziv, where did the Sinas Chinam come from? He said people didn't recognize the fact that there could be differences between them in how they serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. That there are many valid paths to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Chafetz Chaim says that is echoed in the following Gemara. The Gemara says that in the future, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make a big circle for the tzaddikim, and they're all going to stand around the circle and point to the Ribbono Shel Olam in the middle and say, Ze Elokeinu Kiv, this is the God we waited for. Says the Chafetz Chaim, what does that mean? Right, it sounds like kindergarten. Right, everybody dancing around God who's in the middle. What's it mean? He says, what it means is the following. He said, in this world, there are many different kinds of tzaddikim, different approaches to tzidkus. They all accept the to be a tzaddik, Torah shebichsav and Torah shebal peh, and they all learn Torah, and they all do chesed, and they all daven. But the emphasis is different. Some emphasize Torah, and amongst them, there are a million different drachim in Torah learning. There's this opinion and that shita and the other shita, and there's a Sfardish way and an Ashkenazi way and a Litvish way and a Hungarian way and a Polak way. All different approaches to learning Torah. And then there are people who But they also daven and they also do chesed, but their emphasis is Torah. Then there are people who emphasize chesed. And there's all different kinds of chesed organizations. Some people do chesed with yisomim and some with almanos and some with poor people and all different sick people, all kinds of chesed. They also learn and they also daven, but their emphasis is chesed. Some people, the emphasis is davening. And there's all different kinds of davening. This one davens slow and fast and loud and low and this nusach and another nusach. And each one thinks that his derech is the one that goes straight to God. And everybody else is somewhere, you know, out in left field. But Lashid Lava, Kadosh Baruch Hu, is going to put all of them on a circle. And he's going to stand in the middle. And all the radii to the middle are equal. You can have a tzaddik on this side of the circle and another one 180 degrees on the other side. And their drachim, their paths are completely different. But the Rabban Hashem is in the middle and the paths are equal. But you have to be on the circle. There is a condition. If you're not standing on the circle, in other words, you don't accept Tariq Mitzvahs and Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh, then you're off the circle somewhere. Chofetz Chaim said the same thing in a different way. Somebody once asked him, wouldn't it be more streamlined and much more simple if all Jews did the same thing? They dressed the same way, they spoke the same way, they had the same minhagim. Why so many different chassidim and mesnagdim and yekis and all different kinds of drachim? Wouldn't it be better if everybody was the same way? So the Chofetz Chaim said, why do you ask me that question? Ask the Tsar why he has so many different divisions in his armies. Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Cavalry and the Infantry. Wouldn't it be better if everybody did the same thing, had the same uniform, everybody was either on horses or on the ground or in the air, and be much more streamlined? You know what the Tsar will tell you? Yeah, be much more streamlined, be much more economic, but never win a war. To win a war, I got to cover all bases. So too, Klal Yisrael is the army of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we need all different kinds of approaches that are legitimate to be able to win the Rabban Shom's wars. So we need all different kinds of Jews. So that is the Netziv says, and therefore, people then, in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, said that if somebody doesn't serve the Rabban Shom exactly as me, he's an apikoros. And it's a mitzvah to hate apikoros. So they hated each other. L'shem Shammai. And they ended up killing each other. That's not yosher. That's not straight. It could be a chassid and a tzaddik and a lomei Torah, but there's something missing in your yashrus. And because of that, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The Rabban Shalom is not only a tzaddik, he's also a yosher. And yosher means dealing with people, even people who are different than you, but accepting the fact that l'maisa, we're all in this together. And yeah, if you're a Rasha, I should want you to give up your rishus. And if you don't, then Avram Avinu, you know, didn't cry tremendously for when Sodom was destroyed. But he tried everything in his power that they shouldn't be destroyed, because he cared for them. That's called yashar. That's yashrus. You can look up the Netziv, it's in his Hakdama to Hemek Dover to Sefer Bereishis. Okay, next. Time, yeah. Says Zechor Yemos Olam Binu Shnos Dor Vador Sha'al Avicha V'Yagedcha Zekeinecha V'Yom Rulach. Let's start with the end of the pasuk, because that is very short. History has to be learned from two perspectives. First, you have to ask Sha'al Avicha V'Yagedcha. Ask your father, ask the people who were there. You want to know what happened in history? So ask the people who were there and get an eyewitness. Your father was there, you weren't there. Ask him what he saw, what he experienced. And usually what you're going to hear of Jewish history is very harsh. V'yagedcha. Haggadah is dvarim kashim. Harsh words, like Gidim says. And also Haggadah means he will testify to you what he saw. That's the purpose of asking your fathers, grandfathers, people who witnessed things that you didn't witness. Ask them, they will testify, and usually they're going to tell you harsh things, things that are hard to swallow. But then there's a second level. After you know the facts, then ask Zikeinecha, ask Talmidei Chachamim, V'yomru Lach, and they'll tell you how to look at it from the proper perspective. They'll explain to you how to put that those historical happenings into a perspective that takes in consideration the fact that the Rabbanu Shalom runs the world and that there is a continuum of Jewish history. You can't look at things in a vacuum. It's one of the reasons why we mourn all Jewish tragedies on Tisha B'Av and not separately, because they all emanate from one continuum and you have to see them like that. So learning history starts with Sha'al Avicha V'Yagedcha, but it has to have also have Zekeinecha V'Yomrulach. Now let's go to the first part of the pasuk. Zechor Yemos Olam. Remember history. Binu Shnos Dor Vador seems to say, and understand the years of every generation. But there's another way of learning it. Binu Shnos Dor Vador means understand the differences between each generation. No two generations are the same. And therefore what affects one generation and why it affected them and what their nisyonos were, what the Yetzer Hara was, why they were treated a certain way depends a lot on what the unique character of that generation was. Understand shnos, dor vador, the differences between generations. In fact, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says that's why the Torah says that you go el hashofet asher yiyah bayomi mohen. You have to go to the judge who lives in your time. So the Gemara says, do I think you can go to a judge who doesn't live in your time? So of course you have to go to the judge who lives in your time. Ela yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Don't say, oh, I wish I could have gone to the judge in the previous generation. He was so much better. Could have wished I could have gone to the Vilna Gaon. Look at the people today. They're nothing compared to the Vilna Gaon. Right? Don't say that. Every generation, the Gadol fits the generation. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, we normally learn that to mean Nebuch. You know, really, if we could resurrect the Vilna Gaon, that would be ideal. But since we can't, so you have to be satisfied with the show fate of your time. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, no. If we could resurrect the Vilna Gaon, you wouldn't be allowed to go to him, because he doesn't know the generation. Every generation is different. Every person is different. Every situation is different. And you can't deal with all situations and all people and all the same way. Every situation has to be dealt with according to its unique circumstances. I'll give you an example. The Michtam Eliyahu says that every generation has its Yetzer Hara. And the way to fight that Yetzer Hara is with the Yetzer Hara's own tools. Fight fire with fire. Example, he says. The Rambam's generation, the Yetzer Hara, was Greek philosophy, Aristotle. The people were enamored with Greek philosophy, like some people today are enamored with science. And they believed that everything Aristotle said was true. And if he contradicted the Torah, then the Torah was wrong and Aristotle was right. And that's why they were perplexed. They were people who gave up the Torah, who went off the derech. So how did the Rambam combat that? He wrote Mora Nevuchim. He wrote a sefer that basically was based on Greek philosophy, on Aristotle, and he showed that where Aristotle was right, he didn't contradict the Torah. And where he contradicted the Torah, he was wrong. That was Mora Nevuchim. So the Rambam fought the Yetzer Hara of Greek philosophy with Greek philosophy, with philosophy. Now, if you don't think that generations change, not that the Torah changes, but the approach to Torah changes, and the Yetzer Hara changes, then if you want to go into Kiruv, I have a very, very easy solution how you can be Makarov people, if you don't think that things change. Go print up Mora Nevuchim's in the language that people understand. Go to the pubs over here in Kikar Tzion. Hey, don't quote me that I said you should do that. With these Mora Nevuchim's, and get all these estranged youth out of these pubs and say, I know why you're off the derech, because you think that Aristotle is 100% right and you're enamored with Greek philosophy. So I'm going to read you some choice portions from Mora Nevuchim and you will be makariv thousands of people. You know how many people you've makariv? Zero. You know why? The Yetzer Hara of this generation is not Greek philosophy. For that matter, it's not any philosophy. They don't even know who Aristotle is. They think he's a rock star. Most of the people of this generation, you'll forgive me, the deepest thought that they are capable of is, do I want ketchup or mustard on my hamburger? And even that's a little difficult for them to decide. So that's not the Yetzer Hara of this generation, deep philosophical thought. Okay. I sometimes laugh. I have a 11, 12-year-old boy, right, that the father comes to me and says, my son is going off the derech, and he's, what's it called, that he's going, his Michal Shabbos, and he doesn't wear his yarmulke, and he doesn't put on tefillin, which is a bar mitzvah kid coming up, and he has these deep philosophical questions, and that's why he's going, so speak to him and convince him, you know, answer his questions. It's absurd. As a little 12-year-old kid, what's bothering him? Why is he not keeping Shabbos and running around with girls or whatever? Because I don't know, could God make a rock that he can't lift? Right, and that's it. If I just can't answer that question, I just can't believe in anything anymore. That's absurd. That's not what's bothering him. Right, he's not deep philosophical guy who has these philosophical... What's bothering him is Yetzer Hara. Right, he needs an excuse, so he makes up these questions. So answering the question is not going to help. It's dealing with the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara of this generation is not philosophy, it's not deep thought, it's not philosophical questions. There's a lot of materialism and a lot of things that pull a person to tremendous Yetzer Haras, emotional Yetzer Haras, not intellectual Yetzer Haras. And that's the problem. So that's what you have to deal with. So generations change. And what was good in the Rambam's generation is not good in this generation. Tell you one more story to bring it out. We'll probably speak about this again, maybe in Parshas Yisro, from a little bit different standpoint. And one more. When the Chinuch Atzmoi schools here in Eretz Yisro were established in the 1950s, first started with schools that were under the government, and the government was at that time rabidly anti-religious, and its goal was to take religion away from everybody here, they took the Taimanim and the Moroccans and whatever and put them in places where they weren't from, cut off their payas, made them be Michal Shabbos, eat on Yom Kippur. They were communists, and they believed that religion was the opiate of the masses, and they were doing these kids a favor to pull them away from religion. So they did everything in their power. So the Gedolim saw that if we don't have our own school system here, and the school system is under the government, it's not going to last too long that we're going to have children that they're going to be from. So they established Chinuch Atzmoi, the independent school system here, which the government agreed to fund partially, but not to have a say in what is taught. Now they're changing their minds. It's a big issue today. In any case, so the question came, what language would they teach in Chinuch Atzmoi? What would be the language of instruction? So most people assumed that whatever the language is going to be, it's not going to be Hebrew, not going to be Ivrit, because the Yishuv HaYoshen, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, and the people of the old Yishuv fought a holy war against Ivrit. They wouldn't speak it. They spoke Yiddish. They called it Ivrit with two Vavs, the blind language. And they refused to speak it, and they were against the people who were Mechadish, modern Hebrew. So they assumed, there's a story they say, that Eliezer ben Yehuda, who was the father of modern Hebrew, once met Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld at a simcha. And he said to him, I don't understand the Rav, what could you have against Hebrew? It's Lashon HaKodesh. How could you be against Lashon HaKodesh? So supposedly Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld said to him the following. He said, there is something similar to this situation. Wine. Wine could be holy. You could make Kiddush, Havdalah, Koshel Bracha, Sheva Brachas on wine. But if the wrong person touches the wine, it becomes prohibited. Similarly, it says in Shir HaShirim, Chikeich Kiyein HaTov, your palate, your mouth, is like good wine. Just like wine could be holy, but if the wrong person touches it, it becomes usher. So too language can be holy, Lashon HaKodesh. But if the wrong person like you touches it, it becomes prohibited. So supposedly Eliezer ben Yehuda said to Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, Harav medaber shtusin, to which Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld retorted, Be'ivrit omrim shtuyot. In any case, whether it happened or not is irrelevant. But they made a holy war against Hebrew. So they assumed that the language that would be used for the, in the Beis Yaakovs and in the Chinuch Atzmoy boys' schools would not be modern Hebrew. So they went to the Chazon Ish, and he was the one to decide what language would be the language of instruction. And his decision was modern Hebrew. That's the language in the Beis Yaakovs, and that's the language in the Chinuch Atzmoy schools. So they wanted to put the Chazon Ish in Cheirim. There he put his name up on the walls, you know, the Chazon Ish went off the derech. Somebody went to him and asked, how could it be? Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld made a holy war against Hebrew, and you're paskening they should teach in modern Hebrew in our schools? The Chazon Ish said, I'll tell you. If you have a general who was an excellent strategist in World War I, and he won a lot of battles by making a strategy for those battles, and now it's World War II, you take him out of retirement, and you ask him to give you a strategy for an air battle, and he gives you something that's befitting for box planes, put him back in retirement. There's no more box planes. Now it's jets. You have to know what weapons to use, because what kind of battles are going. It's a different war. What was good for World War I is not good for World War II. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was fighting a war that we're not fighting anymore. He was fighting a war against people who grew up in frum homes, who were basically brought up frum. And they left it, and their consciences bothered them. They needed something as a substitute for Torah and mitzvahs to ease their consciences. So they said, in Chutz La'aretz you needed mitzvahs and Torah. But in Eretz Israel, you only need Israel and Hebrew, and that gives you an identity, and you don't need anything else. So they took Hebrew and Eretz Yisrael, and they used it as a substitute for Torah. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was fighting people who were using Hebrew as a substitute for Torah, and therefore, we'll show you, we don't even speak it. It's not a substitute for Torah, it's worthless. Today, he said, we're three generations after that. We lost that battle a long time ago. We're not fighting people who need a substitute for Torah and mitzvahs. We're fighting people who don't have no idea what Torah and mitzvahs are. They're three generations estranged from Yiddishkeit. And if we teach in a language they don't understand, we're going to lose the whole generation. It's a different battle. You need different weapons. That's what the Chazon Ish said. So, binu shno stor vador. Understand the differences between generations, and then you'll understand better why that generation needed this and a different generation needed something else. Why in this generation this is prohibited, and in a different generation that same thing was permitted. Because each generation is different, and therefore each generation has to be dealt with differently. That's the another meaning of Binu Shnos Dor Vador. Okay, one last thing. Let's do something short. The end of the Sedra. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Nevo, the Etzem Hayom Hazeh, the middle of the day. And Rashi brings down other places in the Torah where we have a similar thing. One case was by Noach. It says Noach went into the Teva, the Etzem Hayom Hazeh. Why? Because the people of the generation said that if Noach tries to go into that Teva, we're going to kill him. We won't let him go in. He's not going to save himself. Right? If we die, he dies with us. So the Rabban Hashem said, we'll see. And he made Noach go into the Teva in the middle of the day. And he said to the people, you can stop him, go stop him. And he put bears and lions around the Teva. Nobody could stop him. So Rabban Hashem said, you think you can stop him? Go try. I'm not going to put him in the middle of the night. Middle of the day. See what you can do. Then it says that Klal Yisrael left Mitzrayim be'etzem hayom hazeh. The Mitzrayim said, if we see them trying to leave, we'll stop them. The Rabban Hashem let us leave in the middle of the day and said, anybody want to stop him? Go ahead. See if you can. And similarly, where was the third place? Avram Avinu. It says that he had his bris milah be'etzem hayom hazeh. People in generation said, if he tries to perform this mitzvah, we're not going to let him. And the Rabban Shem said, we'll see. And he did it be'etzem hayom hazeh, the middle of the day. Anybody want to stop him? See if you can stop them. And nobody could stop them. Similarly, Klal Yisrael said, if we see Moshe Rabbeinu trying to go up to Har Nevo and die, we're not going to let it happen. So the Rav Shem said, we're going to do it be'etzem hayom hazeh and see what you can do. Now, I understand how you can stop Noach from going into the Teva. I also understand how you can stop Avraham Avinu from performing Bris Milah or Klal Yisrael from leaving Mitzrayim. How do you stop somebody from dying? Right? If we see Moshe Rabbeinu trying to go up Har Nevo, we're going to stop him from dying. What, hold his hand so he can't have a heart attack? What exactly could they do to stop somebody from dying? It doesn't make sense. So some say that since the Rabbanu Shlom said he had to go first up the mountain and then die, that if somehow they could prevent him from going up the mountain, then he couldn't die, because one was dependent on the other. Okay, but the Rabbanu Shlom could take him, put him up the mountain too. So how do you prevent somebody from dying? So I was thinking the lesson over here is different. Enochanami, Klal Yisrael couldn't do anything. Right? They couldn't prevent him from dying. But what it means is the following. Moshe Rabbeinu had just given them a shiur from Rosh Chodesh Shvat till Zayin Adar. That was a month and 7 days of straight Musar. Okay, pretty strong words. Now, you would imagine that by this time, as much as they like Moshe Rabbeinu, right, they said, you know what, enough. Moshe, you're going, bye, Gesunter Heit, you know, nice knowing you, but we had enough. That's what you could imagine the Jewish people would say. You know, we're really, you know, sad to see you go, but there's enough. A month and 7 days of Musar straight. But the Rebbeinu Shalom said in the Torah that he knows that if the Jewish people could have prevented Moshe's death, even though it would have meant more Moshe, they would have done it. Not that they thought they could do it, but psychologically, if they could have done it, they would have stopped it. That's a tremendous shevach for Klal Yisrael. That with all the Moshe that Moshe gave them, they still would have wanted him to be around, and they didn't sigh a sigh of relief that, well, finally this is getting coming to the end. If they could have stopped it, they would have stopped it. That's what it means. Not that they thought they could stop it, not that there was a chance, but just to tell us that if there was any possible way of extending Moshe's life, they would have done it, even though he's just been giving them a month and a third of a month and a quarter of Musar. Okay.